where are we up to in Sota? Did we get to the Daf Gimel Amud Beis yet?
Let me see. It was Lo Yitama.
Lo Yitama on Gimel Amud Aleph?
I think
the last line on Gimel Amud Aleph?
I think the bottom on Gimel Aleph.
All right, so that seems to be a good place.
Yeah.
A good place to get started.
I made a point. I said that
we'll have to close the door just because I don't hear
the competing noises.
Yeah. So you want to do that for me, or I'll do it. Whatever.
The law is the big discussion. And
right.
Rabbi Shmuel says, if I recall, the law segregates and focuses, making it. Well, he says it's a rashus. So the law.
Well, kinui? He's talking about kinui? Kinui? He's talking about kinui, meaning giving a warning to your wife?
Yeah.
It's a rashus. And Rabbi Akiva is the one who says it's a chovah, right?
A chovah. And so it's Rabbi Akiva who focuses on law, on her. And I made a point, I said, shouldn't the lashon be not law yitama, but yitama law? From a proper grammatical point.
Again, what does the pasuk say? It doesn't say yitama la.
It says la yitama. And I'm saying that the way it's arranged with the words la and yitama, that perhaps the fact that it is accentuating the law puts the law before the word yitama. Wouldn't the normal progression be yitama law rather than law yitama?
Well, it depends. If you have a general rule and you set up an exception to that rule, then the Torah will change the grammatical order of words. So, for example, a kohen is not allowed to defile himself by contracting tumah, correct?
Right. Except growth.
Now the Torah wants to give an exception to the rule. Once the Torah wants to give an exception to that rule, it's going to change the grammatical order of the words for a very simple reason. Because it wants to tell you even more than that, let me just try to emphasize my point, that this is the exception, but there are no other exceptions. How does the Torah indicate that this is an exception to the rule, but this is the only exception to the rule? And don't try to extrapolate and break down the rule completely and break all the barriers. So how does the Torah indicate that? By using the word law. Law, as the switching around of the grammatical sequence of words, tells you law, that this is the woman that you're allowed to, and maybe even obligated to bury, even though you're a Kohen. But don't start extrapolating and extending it and generalizing it to other women. So the law comes first. You know, you're right. Basically, according to the Hebrew grammar, it should have said, Yitama Allah. He should become defiled to her. Why does the Torah switch it around? Because here we have a case of an exception to a general rule. Whenever there's an exception to the general rule, the Torah has to indicate that by switching around the order.
Right.
So now, Rabosai, I don't know, it seems that I had something prepared in terms of law, but if you would prefer, I don't know if there, we didn't. I don't know if we took a democratic vote. I think Yaakov decided that we should learn Sota. So the question is where we can begin. I mean, you have to give me a point here. I was thinking of Daf Gimel Amud Aleph. Is that towards the end of the daf?
At the end of the daf.
That would give us a chance to sort of backpedal a little bit before we move on to Gimel Amud Beis. So keep in mind that we have a dispute between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel, and that dispute repeats itself three times over, and the consistency here is the following: that whenever there's an exception to the rule, according to Rabbi Shmuel, that exception is called a reshus. So the Torah is not in favor of advocating in favor of doing such a thing, but rather the Torah allows you. It's what we call permission. Are you familiar with that term, reshus? You should write it down. Reshus means permission. Rabbi Akiva goes one step further, and he says chova. Chova means obligation. Yeah, are you with me? So that, for example, in the case of a kohen, that we say the general rule is that he's not allowed to contract tumah, but the exception to the rule would be in the case of his wife, let's say, right? So the Torah says la yitama, that he should be defiling himself for the sake of the burying of his wife. What does that mean? He should be, or he's allowed to? So that's Ben Khan, Rabbi Shmuel, and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Shmuel is going to say he is allowed to. It's a reshus. The Torah's not advocating. No one's pushing him to bury his wife. And Rabbi Akiva is going to take the other approach, that it's a chova.
He has to.
He doesn't have a choice in the matter. And then I think I mentioned to you once in the past, if you remember, before I got sick, I've been in bed for a week now. I can't seem to shake this cold, but I think I'm turning the corner now. Bezer Hashem. The Yerushalmi talks about one of the Amoraim who went by his wife's casket and he didn't want to touch it. And the other Amoraim, the other great giants, they pushed him against the coffin because they held like Rabbi Akiva that it's a chova.
And I mean, the Kohen has to do it if there's nobody else.
That this is his obligation. He has to respect his wife and bury her. Well, again, I don't know if he has to actually dig the grave and lay the body into the grave, but he, at the very minimum, he has to come in contact with his wife's body, in which case he becomes tameh. So I remember when we were learning this with our Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, we asked him why would the Torah say that he has to be mitami himself. After all, there are many other people who are willing to do the job for him. You know, there's a chevra kadisha.
Yeah,
I don't know if you've ever gone through this. Unfortunately, I had to go through this a few times with my relatives. You pay good money for the chevra kadisha. They're not wealthy people. Don't misunderstand me. So, but once you're paying them, you know, why should the kohen have to defile his kedushas kahuna? Why not just rely on the chevra kadisha? I promise you, you can be calm. They'll do a good job. So this is a question we asked Rav Soloveitchik. And he answered the following, very interesting. He said that the mitzvah burial is part of what's called avelus, which, you know, again, in a loose translation into English would be mourning or grief. And he vacillated back and forth about the following. What is avelus? Is it A or B? Is it a compilation or we'll call it a constellation of isurim, of prohibitions? For example, who remembers some of the prohibitions, I'll test you, of an avel?
No,
is he allowed to wear shoes?
No.
Not allowed to wear shoes. Yeah, is he allowed to wash his body with warm water? No, he's not allowed to wash his body. Is he allowed to smear his body with oils and so forth and so on? So if you go through, the Rambam actually compiles 11 different prohibitions, the constellation, the totality of which makes up avelus. Or no. These 11 prohibitions that are incumbent on an avel are simply methods or shall we say a means to an end. The end is to be an avel, and to be an avel and to experience avelus is not just refraining from violating isurim, but it's also a kiyum. Now again, I have to spend a minute just to explain what the word kiyum means. Kuf, yud, vav, mem, right? We divide the Torah into two parts. Half of which is, it's not exactly half, but half of which are isurim, are prohibitions, and the other half are kiyumim. Kiyumim means the fulfillment of a mitzvah saseh. And here Rav Soloveitchik broke new ground, and he says that avelus is a kiyum of a mitzvah. We'll see if you're interested how he proves this. That avelus is not just to avoid isurim, that you and I have X number of isurim prohibitions, and the avel has another 11. It's not just that. Those 11 are really just a means to achieve the end. The end and the goal is a kiyum of avelus. It's to bring the avel into a state of avelus. I'll give you an example. What would you tell me about a Jew who lost one of his relatives, and he's an Ovel, and he's very meticulous, you know, he has all the books. I don't know if you've ever gone to a base Ovel, you'll see they have all the books on mourning and halacha, you know, all there strewn around the book, you know, around the table. And he's very meticulous, but he's happy. He's in a great mood. Did he fulfill his mitzvah avelus?
Yes.
And Rav Soloveitchik says it's meaningless. Nothing. It's worthless. Because Rav Soloveitchik had proofs that avelus is not an isur, and not even a compilation or constellation of 11 isurim, but that avelus is a kiyum mitzvah. And a kiyum mitzvah is to be in a state of avelus. It's a psychological, spiritual, inner state of being. And if he's not in that inner state of being, I couldn't care less how many surim he observes and how meticulous he is about the observance of those asurim. He has forfeited the entire purpose of avelus. Avelus is a state of being.
A kavana.
Kavana, I think, could be a good word, intention. But I think a state of being means a psychological state of avelus. In fact, the Gemara vacillates in sukkah whether an ovel is chayv in the midst of sukkah or not, because to be in the sukkah you have to be in a state of simcha, you know, that God is protecting you in the sukkah. Maybe an ovel is in the state of avelus and therefore he's excluded from a sukkah. The Gemara goes back and forth on that point.
But so many houses of mourning you go into, you get more nechama from the people about telling you these stories and everything, and they're not in a morbid state. They're coming out
right
and giving you nechama.
The kiyum of avelus is not morbidity. The kiyum of avelus is what we call respecting the dead. What does that mean, respecting the dead? When I respect the dead, my sense of being is that this is an irreversible loss. That the loss that I've sustained cannot be replaced. That's what avelus is all about. If you come into a base avel and you tell him, you know, who won, you know, in the playoffs in the Australian, what do they call it, that game that the Australians
cricket.
Love to play? Cricket? Yeah, and the cricket scores. That's not what avelus is all about. If you come into a base avel, and either you know something about the niftar, about the person who died, and you can share that, you know, some jewel of a story, or alternatively, you don't know anything about the niftar, but you come in to learn about the niftar, and you want to hear stories, you want to understand it. That's what avelus is all about. Avelus is to try something that unfortunately we don't do when a person is alive. That's the paradox of human existence. We never ask ourselves during the lifetime of a close relative, what's unique about that person? What does that person give me? How did he enhance my life? What did I learn from that person? How could I emulate them? These are questions that for some reason elude us. They just are not on our screen until we're chayv in the mitzvah nemach of avelus. And a person goes and he's gone or she's gone, and all of a sudden we ask the question, who was she? And we'll see this at the beginning of Parshas Chayisara, when Avram buries his wife Sarah, and for the first time he asks the question, who was she? And the first Rashi tells us about all the miracles that she brought in, and how her life was a complete, total string of beautiful, gracious goodness from the beginning to the end. She was Me'av Yesru V'Sheva Shanim, and she was as beautiful at the age of seven as she was 20, and she was not guilty of any averus like a woman of 20, like at the age of 127, etc., etc. All of a sudden, there's a mitzvah of hesped. Are you familiar with that word, hesped?
Yeah. Eulogy.
A eulogy. Hesped is a word in Parshas Chayisara, and it says that Avraham Avinu came livkos es Sara ula haspida. Haspida is the conjugated verb of the noun hesped. That's what avelus is all about. Avelus is one long extended hesped. And it's unbelievable in the case of parents. it goes on for a full year, you know. You know, even after a year, I think there's some still some lingering avelus. I, you know, my sister, for example, she dreams about my father. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, my father's gone, I'm not sure, upwards of 25 years for sure. And she sees him in her dreams, you know, she speaks to him. And I'm not in that state, or if I am, I don't remember my dreams. But I certainly long for my father. And that's called hesped. So Alan, I think, Alan is your first name?
Yeah.
Right. Alan, I think what you're saying is absolutely correct, that if you come into the Beis Avel and the Avel starts describing to you the midos, you know, the attributes of the person who passed on, and you can now link into that, that is the greatest fulfillment of Hesped. But if you come in and you say, well, you know what? Our team won the World Series. You know, let's be happy. That's not what Avelis is all about. Avelis is not about happiness. It's not about being depressed. I don't say that you have to. In fact, an Avel is chayv in all mitzvahs HaTorah, including not being depressed. You know, I don't know if any of you are Bratzim or Chassidim. You know, in Bratzim, the worst Avera is to be depressed. An Avel is not allowed to be depressed. But he has to be in a state of halachic Avelis. And halachic Avelis means constant awareness of the loss without what's called Hesek Hadas. Hesek Hadas means discontinuity. He should not be thinking about anything but his loss. He's not thinking about the beauty of his physical body. He's not involved in washing himself. He's basically completely unkempt because he is totally obsessed and single-mindedly focused on the loss.
Okay. Can I just say something there?
I'm going to get back to Cohen. I haven't forgotten where I'm trying to get to. You know, we want to understand why they pushed the Cohen to be Matami to his wife. Yeah.
It's in my humble opinion, but what you're saying is contradictory to what we taught. We taught to do everything because when we get up to the next world, that's where we're going to enjoy all our mitzvahs. So in other words, that person has achieved that level of getting up there to achieve their mitzvahs, so we should be happy for them because they have gone on to that.
Maybe you're right, but that's not avelus. You know, you're right. I should be happy for the person who died because that person is now going up and up and up in levels of the divine, of closeness to the divine being. It's an neshama that's no longer, you know, incarcerated here in the goof. But that's not avelus. Avelus is what did I lose? Not what did he gain. You understand my point?
Yeah.
You can ask a question, well, what did the nifter gain now that he's in a world which is eternal? That's not avelus. The question that you should be addressing yourself in avelus, Rachmanu Tzad, I don't wish it on anybody, I did it three times already in my life, is what am I missing as an avel? What is the gap and the gaping hole in my life in the absence of that person who meant so much to me? And again, that forces us to ask, what did that person mean to me? How is that person unique? And the hashkaf of Chazal is that there are no two people the same. Every person is irreversible, is irreplaceable. Every human being is unique. Why God gives one human being X number of years and another human being Y number? We'll never know the answer to that question. But what we do know is that as long as that person walked this earth, they had a unique contribution to give that no one else could give. The Mishnah says in the Sefer Sanhedrin, Lama Nivra Adam Yechidi. Why was man created as one single being? God could have created man, Adam v'Chava. Instead, he did the whole thing, you know. So the Mishnah answers to teach us that one human being is worth an entire world. Which means that a human being is irreplaceable. That's what Avelis is all about. And Avelis doesn't have to be depression. Avelis has to be appreciation, evaluation, it has to be eulogy, it has to be hesped, it has to be what we call in Yiddish, shotsing up a person, you know, to evaluate what was unique about that person. In my humble opinion, the greatest thing you could do if you come into a base Avel is to ask the Avel or any one of the Avelim, what can I learn? What can I emulate? I'm going to walk out of here in about 5 minutes, in a half hour, whatever it is. What can I take from the contribution of this person who's no longer with us that I can emulate as I go through my life. And that would be the greatest aliyas neshama also for the person who died. So that when we talk about, you know, comforting the bereaved, there are two dimensions here. One is kavod ames. We're really honoring the deceased because we're asking what we can learn from the deceased. Maybe, unfortunately, we didn't learn, we beat our breasts that we didn't learn enough during that lifetime. But now, posthumously, what can I learn? How can I emulate that person? What were his great attributes? And number two is kavod achayim. Because we are identifying with the person's loss. We are telling the person, we are with you. We understand what you're going through to some extent. Obviously not the way you're going through it, but you sustain the loss. And that loss cannot be replaced. A man loses his wife. Never. Chazal say terrible, you know, Ein Isha Mesel Labaila. I mean, the only person who really, really appreciates her loss in this world is her own husband. He can get married again. The Torah is not opposed to that. And even if he's the Kohen Gadol, he can get married again. But there's something unique about his first wife that cannot be replaced by his second. And that's a difficult concept for us to swallow. I mean, maybe the second wife is greater. She's more, you know, she's more of a scholar, and she's got a PhD, and she's a lecturer in university, and she's more beautiful, and you can go on and on and on. But it's not the same. And that concept that it's not the same and it never will be the same is Avelus. That's what Avelus is all about. Now, here's the case that I want to discuss with you. There's a Kohen. A Kohen lost one of his close relatives. And now he's obligated in the mitzvah of kvura, of burial, which is part, as I said before, of the mitzvah of Avelus. So he has Avelus. But you know, in halacha, there's always a tug of war. There's always a conflict. Wonderful. He's chayiv in avelus. But a kohen is not allowed to be metami lemes. He has what's called kiddushas kuhuna. He has a sanctity that, I don't know if there are any kohenim in the audience, but that you and I don't have. I mean, if you're not a kohen. Yeah, I wanted to pay a rabbi $500, but it didn't help me. Right? You can't become a kohen. Either you're born with it or you don't have it. So I don't have it. You know, do I wish I was a Kohen? I'm not sure. You know, I have enough mitzvahs and enough challenges not being a Kohen. You know, but in any event, so what do we do in this conflict situation? So the Torah goes out of its way, according to Rabbi Akiva, to say, La yitama. Yitama means contaminate yourself. Why? Because what could bring a Kohen to the greatest expression of the fact that life is now topsy-turvy, that he has suffered an irreplaceable loss, the fact that he desecrates his Kiddushas Kuhuna. That's what I heard from my Rebbe. And again, he didn't say everything that I said, but this last sentence I heard from my Rebbe. Rav Soloveitchik said that the Torah obligates the Kohen. The Kohen can remain distant, called a little bit, you know, and say, let the Chevra Kadisha bury the dead. Why do I have to get involved? That's not Avelus. The Torah wanted to show that the Kohen, Dafka, because he's endowed with a special high level of Kedusha, he has a unique obligation and a unique opportunity to demonstrate the fact that his life is totally upside down. He has lost, he sustained a loss that he'll never be able to replace. That's just the way life is. Ask when you get up to the pearly gates, you'll ask the man with the big G on his sweatshirt. You know, maybe he'll explain it to you. I don't know. But God created us in such a way that we die and that's it. You know, there'll be Olam Haba, and of course that's what we're waiting for, but in this world, death is right now final. And life is upside down. By the way, I don't know if you learned about this, because this is a Gemara that you should have seen. The Masechta that you learned before this was Tainus?
Yes.
Yes. So maybe you might remember from Masechta Tainus, it's probably a few months ago, a concept called Kfias Hamita in Avelus. Do you remember that? The Avel is not allowed to sleep on his bed. What he has to do is, he has to turn his bed upside down and sleep on an upside down bed. Why? Strange. It sounds like spooky, you know, like sorcery or something of that sort. It's suspicion. Suspicious. A lot of religions have a lot. All of loss of human life is always surrounded with superstitions. You know, we had a Filipino woman who took care of my mother, and my mother actually died when the Filipino was in the apartment, and the Filipino would never go back into that apartment again. Never walk in. And eventually, you know, we never saw her again. She just flew out of our life. We gave her a last payment, and that was it. We loved her. I mean, she was a great woman. But, you know, death is like really spooky. So why is the Avil sleeping on an upside down bed? And the answer is because life is upside down for him. He's no longer watching his body the way it should, you know, taking care of his body. He's no longer kempt. He's unkempt. The Ramban in Nachmanides identifies Avelus as Nivul. Nivul, I don't know, it's very hard to translate that word Nivul into Hebrew. But Nivul means when you're totally ignoring all your physical needs, you know, to look good, you know. And, you know, they tell you every morning you should brush your teeth, you should comb your hair, you know, take a shower in the morning. Forget about all that. You're an Avel now. Life is upside down. You have just sustained a major loss. And that's going to express itself in sleeping on an upside down bed. And according to Rabbi Akiva, in the case of a Kohen, to make his life upside down, he has to desecrate his sanctity as a Kohen. Because that's his unique endowment as a Kohen, that he carries with him a Kedushas Kahuna, up until a point in which he touches the dead, or he finds himself in the same Ohel as a dead. And at that point, he desecrates his Kahuna. And for him, because of the unique nature of a Kohen as being sanctified with Kedushas Kuna, his greatest expression of how much this loss has completely rendered his life topsy-turvy is the fact that he's Metami himself, and he personally gets involved in burying the dead. Whose opinion is that?
Akiva.
Rabbi Akiva, because Rabbi Akiva says, Chova. Of course, the Gemara says, La Yitami Rishus, which means, Divrei Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yishmael is of the opinion that it's only Rishus. Rabbi Akiva Omer Chova. My time with Rabbi Yishmael. So what's the explanation for Rabbi Yishmael? This is three lines up before the end of Daf Gimel Omer Aleph. And the Gemara answers the following. Aidi Dichsiv. Now Aidi is a difficult word in Aramaic to translate. You can't really translate it literally, but ID, because ID is always an introduction to the flip side, if you follow what I mean. So ID means, since it says X, he's got to tell you Y. But you should always see Y in the context of X. Again, all that sounds like a lot of gibberish to you, but let's try to fit it in and give it some flesh. ID, the Sid. Since the Torah says, "Emara la kohen b'nei Aaron v'yomar talem lenefesh lo yitama," the kohen have to maintain the sanctity of kahuna, which means that they're not allowed to have contact with any sort of tumah, and a kohen is enjoined from contaminating himself to the dead. Now the Torah itzuch lemichtav. The Torah says, "La yitama." And you know what? La Yitama means, for the sake of La, let's say his wife or any of the other six relatives, you know, totaling seven relatives that are close relatives to him. Yitama means the Torah is going to take the prohibition of La Yitama and flip it around. What's the flip side of La Yitama? Yitama! Are we happy about it? Remember Rabosai, the classical case of Rishus, according to one opinion, is pikuach nefesh. It's Yom Kippur, and the doctor says you have to eat. So what am I going to eat? Am I going to eat kisuda shloma melch b'shaito? Am I going to take out a massive banquet and serve, or what do they call them? Caviar, you know what I'm saying? And then a 7-course meal with the most fine steak, you know, in the world that's been seared, you know, and soaked for weeks. Never, you have to eat on Yom Kippur. Don't make such a big deal about it. It's a reshus. The Torah says you're not allowed to eat on Yom Kippur, but in your case, you're a choleh. So the Torah says you're allowed to eat on Yom Kippur. So too, in the case of a Kohen, according to Rabbi Shmuel, the Torah says you're not allowed to be metame. What, all of a sudden, because you lost one of your close relatives, therefore you're no longer a Kohen? The Torah says, lo yitama, you know, we'll give it a reshus. Rabbi Akiva says something else. I remember my wife was in her 8th month pregnancy, and I asked Rav Soloveitchik, does she have to fast on Yom Kippur? So he says, how's she doing? I said, she's doing fine. She has to fast. But then he adds the following. And if she sees the following symptoms, then she should break her fast. So I said to him, Rebbe, what do you mean she should break her fast? Should she eat small portions, you know, extend? He got very angry. He says she should eat There's a whole parak in Melachim that describes how many cows they had to shech for one meal at the time of Shlomo. How many breads they brought in from all over the world. They had every single bread you ever dreamt of. You don't have to pass, you know, through Angel's Bakery to smell the cooking in the kitchen of the palace of Shlomo HaMelech. So my Rebbe said to me, if she sees those symptoms, she should eat kishlo, as soon as Shlomo HaMelech b'shaita. There's no Yom Kippur for her. And that reflects the shita of Rabbi Akiva, which is called chova. Chova means the Torah is not begrudging you, allowing you, you know, because of the circumstances, to violate an isur. You're not violating an isur. The Torah wants you to do what you have to do. If your avelus as a kohen expresses itself in being metame, then your chova, you're obligated to contaminate yourself to the dead, and that's part of your avelus. And if your mitzvah v'chai bohem, to grant life and not to die for the sake of a mitzvah, obligates you to eat on Yom Kippur, then eat as much as your heart desires. By the way, thank God my wife did not have to eat on Yom Kippur, but I'm just telling you the story as it happened.
What's the greater reward, becoming Batami or burying his? I mean, you've got somebody you say who could bury him.
Yeah,
bury his wife. Is it an honor to bury his wife, or is it a
so
greater honor?
So that's a machlokus, Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva. Ah. Rabbi Shmuel is going to say, let the Chevra Kadisha take care of it. Mm. Why do you have to get personally involved?
Yeah, but I'm saying, can you classify what is a greater mitzvah?
Again, it depends. For a Kohen. It depends how you paskin. If you paskin Rabbi Akiva,
if you were a Kohen.
No, I'm saying if I would accept Rabbi Akiva, let's say you came to me and you asked me, should you be metame for the sake of burying one of your close relatives and you're a Kohen, I would say, let's accept Rabbi Akiva. Again, we have to see in the poskim if they accept Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva says, you have to be metame the next. Don't rely on anybody else. Don't give away that opportunity. Your avelus, your expression of, as I said before, how your life has been turned upside down, is the fact that you are metame your kedushas kahuna, and you desecrate your kahuna. How does Rabbi Akiva see this in the psukim? You know, in the actual verses, he says, "Me ki im l'sheiro," from the pasuk ki im l'sheiro. Those three words, nafka, he derives it. Does anybody know what the literal translation of the word nafka means? Just nafka, literal.
Nafka mina. What's nafka mina? Oh.
Take it out.
To take it out. Anything that goes out is called nafka.
What's nafka mina?
Nafka mina means what comes out of this controversy. What difference does it make? The opposite of nafka is ailele. Aile means to go in, and nafka means to go out. So nafka, you know, in an idiomatic sense, means whatever you derive from something. To derive means to take it out. So he says the following. He says that, you know what? If the purpose of the pasuk, and he's arguing here against Rabbi Shmuel, is the position that the pasuk is only coming to allow the Kohen to contract tumah by contaminating himself, then it would have been enough to say ki im l'sheiro, Right? We go back to the original klal. The klal, the general rule was, emara el hakohanim b'nei Aaron, v'emarta aleihem l'nefesh lo yitama. Now you want to have an exception to that rule. So it could have said ki'im, with the exception of, ki'im means with the exception of, l'she'iro, his wife. So why did the Torah add the words lo yitama? If lo yitama, according to you, Rabbi Yishmael, is the purpose of which is to allow the Kohen to be metame himself, I don't need those words lo yitama. All I need are the words ki'im l'she'iro. Right? If you have a rule and you want to give an exception to the rule, you say with the exception of. But then after the Torah says with the exception of, and it gives you this long list of relatives, where the Torah, according to Rabbi Shmuel, is allowing the Kohen, permitting him to become Tomei, then why did the Torah have to add a whole new word, lo yitama? Apparently, lo yitama is telling me an obligation. La, for her benefit, meaning for the purpose of burying her, yitama, he will metame himself. And that is the fulfillment of his mitzvah. It's unbelievable, Rabosai, that sometimes the violation of an isur can become a mitzvah. And that's what's happening here, according to Rabbi Akiva. The violation of the isur for a Kohen to be metame himself, now in the case of his seven relatives, goes from one extreme to the other. Instead of being a prohibition, it becomes what?
A
mitzvah. A chova.
There is no more isur. Isur goes away.
But it's more than that. That's what I'm trying to point out to you. You know, you Rabbi Shmuel would say the Isser goes away, so you're allowed to do. Rabbi Akiva says no. The Isser itself is the mitzvah. Uh-huh. Do you hear the paradox?
Yeah.
How can you say such a thing? Mm-hmm. This is Rabbi Akiva's phenomenal revolution, that the violation of the Isser is your mitzvah. Your mitzvah is to violate this Isser.
Uh-huh.
I would even venture a guess that if for reason X, Y, or Z, the Kohen would be allowed to be metame himself, let's say it would be a situation of extreme danger and so forth and so on, there would be no mitzvah for him to bury his dead because he's not violating the Isser, because in any event he was allowed to bury the dead. What makes this into an obligation is the fact that he's violating the Isser. Do you see the paradox? It's very profound.
Mm-hmm.
For Rabbi Yishmael, so Rabbi Yishmael now is really in trouble. Why did the Torah have to say lo yitama? It's completely superfluous. So he says this has to do with the laws of Tumah v'Tahara. He says, lo yitama means for the whole body. Lo, she's intact. The eno mitame li evareha.
Bones.
Was anybody here in the room by chance with me at 8 o'clock on Shabbos? This past Shabbos? No? Let me just tell you what I discussed on Shabbos. Very fascinating question. A Kohen Nebuch had a finger severed. And the question is, you and I will laugh at the question, is he allowed, you know, within a certain span of time, I don't know exactly how long it is, don't ask me, maybe it's 5 minutes, maybe it's 2 minutes, you can still reattach a severed limb and it becomes alive again. What do you say?
Sew
it back on. And the question is he allowed to have this limb sewn back on? Maybe you'll laugh at that question. I mean, what would be the problem?
It becomes tummy as soon as it is.
Exactly. A limb, once it dies, meaning once it's detached from the body, it becomes tummy.
Uh-huh.
And the Kohen is not allowed to be metame himself. The moment I attach this limb to the body of the Kohen,
he's tummy.
You are being metame him.
But
the ultimate, I just don't want anyone here to get nervous. The ultimate heter here, the Radbaz, is that the loss of a limb is like loss of a life. But so I don't want you to understand that, you know, I don't want anyone to walk out of here thinking you're not allowed to reattach the limb. But the question is a different one. The question is, when you reattach the limb, does the Kohen have to, you know, get what's called mechatos? Did you learn about mechatos? Meaning, when a person is tovi lemes, he has to go through hazav v'shlishi v'shvi, and he needs the paraduma in order to be metire himself. Basically, the issue of the poskim in stage one is whether or not attaching this limb to the body, or reattaching this limb to the body of the Kohen, is Mitami the Kohen. What were you saying? Sorry, I forgot your name.
Gene. Yeah. Yeah, you're saying the finger, it's not dead when it's first.
Gene, you're on the right track.
I think medically,
some poskim want to say that the limb is not considered a dead limb because it can be revived, but all the poskim reject this, Gene. Don't get sensitive about it, okay? it's not that your logic is not correct, but the halacha works with its own rules and regulations. And the rule of regulation is if you have an aver, an organ of a body that is now, at this moment, not attached, so the Gemara says that such an organ is metame. So, for example, there's no issue that if some Kohen or anybody would come along and touch that limb before it's reattached, he would contract tumor. But wait a second. But what is the possible heter? So there's a group of poskim, and at the head of the group was, what's his name? Oh, it'll come to me in a second. Anyway, at the head of the group was one of the great poskim, and he claims that the very second that you attach that limb back to the body, it becomes revived and its status changes. There's a transformation. Mm-hmm. This way I can fulfill Rabbi Meyer's requirement of contemporary halacha. What did he call it? Modern law, I think he called it, right? So that this is modern law. This has to do with transplants. For example, you know that the first transplants from cadavers were, if I'm not mistaken, were cornea transplants. So you take the cornea out of the dead body and you transplant it into the recipient. And the question is, we're not allowed to have hanah from any part of a dead body. Mm. We cannot benefit from any part of a dead body. I don't know if you know that. So the question is, how are you allowed to benefit from a transplant? Again, today it's you can take a heart out of a dead body. Hopefully you wait until the person dies. That's a different question. But anyway, there's no Zrizim Akdimim Levitzis here. But in any event, so the poskim want to say the following, that the organ of the dead body is no longer the organ of the dead body. The very moment that you transplanted and it's received by the recipient, now you've resurrected it from the dead, and it's not metame. And if it's not metame, it's because you've transformed its status, and therefore you're not violating the Isur of Hanoam and Ames. You're not benefiting from a dead body, because it's not part of the dead body. It's integrated into what?
Yours.
Into the new body. Do you hear this? And the proof of this is a Gemara in Yevamos about Ben Ashunamis. You may remember that the Shunamis was very gracious and magnanimous to Elisha Hanavi. She built him a whole attic room over there and so on. And when he said, "What can I do for you?" he wanted to somehow repay her. So Gehazi, whatever, though, I don't want to go into the details, she's childless. So he gave her a bracha, and 9 months later she gave birth to a son. Unfortunately, when the son grew up and his father took him out to the kotzrim, out to the fields, the son got sick. Actually he died, but the father didn't know that he was dead. And she, the Shunamis, now runs to the Navi, to Elisha, to tell him what happened. And Elisha runs back, and they lay the boy down, and he puts his eyes over the mouth to mouth, resuscitation, and he comes back to life. So the Gemara wants to know whether the body of the Ben HaShunamis is Metame, because he was dead. If he was dead, then he becomes a corpse, and he's a source of tumor. The Gemara says, no, he's not a corpse, because he's now alive. So you see, you can take a dead part of the body that contaminates, and you can make it into a live body. So this is something I discussed on Saturday in my morning shiur. And Rabbi Shmuel says that although the organ of a body is metame, but nevertheless, the organ of the body, if it's a separate organ, is not included in the halacha of lo yitama, which means according to Rabbi Shmuel, the permission for a kohen to bury. So let's say Nebuch, you know, the body was strewn about. Unfortunately, we live in a world where that happens a little bit too often. And the question is, they have now part of her body, and that's called Evareha. That's called her severed limbs. So let's say, for example, this person who died lost a limb, and the question is, for the sake of burying that one limb, is the Kohen allowed to be metame himself? So the Torah goes out of its way, according to Rabbi Shmuel, to say la yitam. Allah means her body as a whole. But if her body is now separated into parts, and there are individual organs, then even though we have a mitzvah to bury those organs, I don't want anyone to get the misimpression, but nevertheless, that's not enough, according to Rabbi Shmuel, to permit the Kohen to contract contamination.
And if she just lost a finger years ago, if she's just missing a finger,
but the rest of her body is complete, that's okay, as long as she's functioning as a viable being. Now at this point, Rabosai, we have to turn to Daf Gimel Amud Beis. Rabbi Akiva used the pasuk Lo Yitama to upgrade Rishus to Chova. He no longer has this pasuk Lo Yitama to teach us that in the case of an Aver, in the case of an organ, there's no mitzvah to be metame. He calls it a limb here in this English translation. I called it an organ. Okay, fine. So the Gemara,
but Emma, yeah, there's a difference in that, because a hand is a limb.
Yeah.
The heart, the lung, or whatever is an organ. So
yeah. Right. So I would use the word organ. I don't know. He used the word limb. It's a little. I think he used the word limb.
It's in the term of the Gemara.
Yeah, he's using limb in a historical context.
No way. You could lose a hand and survive.
Right.
Not a heart.
Right. So anyway, if you're on Gimel Amud Beis, you'll see on the second line, on the first line,
I'll throw from here, mister.
It says Im Kain. You see Aleph Chaf. Aleph Chaf is Rashi Tevis, is an abbreviated form of Im Kain.
Oh yeah, top of the line.
Yeah, you have it, top of the line.
Yeah, third
line. Lichtov Rachman Allah V'lishtok. Now, the word V'lishtok means shtika. Shtika means to say nothing, but really, we're using it again a little bit liberally to mean lishtok. It didn't have to say it. That's what it means, silent. In other words, if the Torah just simply is talking about the burial of an organ of the body and telling you that for that you don't allow the Kohen to get buried, then the Torah just sort of said the word la, and that would have been enough. But yet the Torah adds another word, yitama, lamali. Why did the Torah? What justifies the extra words?
No.
The extra word yitama, shmamina. So Rabbi Akiva wants to derive from this that you have an obligation to bury, if you're a Kohen, to bury the close relatives. Rabbi Shmuel, again, it flips back, as you know from your experience in Gemara, it always goes back and forth. What is Rabbi Shmuel going to do with the extra word yitama? And the answer is that sometimes the Torah speaks in what we call Lashon B'nei Adam. In other words, the Torah speaks in the way that we would speak.
Vernacular?
In terms of the vernacular. So it says, I the sins, the kasav la. So the Torah adds kasav nami, it also adds the words yitama. Because otherwise, la sort of like is suspended in midair. Kedetani, and we learned this in the Brisa of Debei Rabbi Shmuel, in the Yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel. And it says, kol parsha Shenemra v'nishneis lo nishneis elav shil dover sheniskadish lo. Alright, I don't know, did you spend any time on this? Yeah. This is a whole, I don't know if I'm not sure if I'm ready for this, but basically, to give it to you in a nutshell, just for the sake of Chazara purposes, because I really want to get to the next Gemara about Leola Mahem Tavodu, and we don't have that much time, but the Gemara wants to say that sometimes the Torah will repeat words for emphasis. And by emphasizing something, it adds a little bit of a nuance of a chidush. A chidush means a new teaching. So here, since according to Rabbi Shmuel, the Torah wanted to add the word law to teach us that in the case of a single organ, the Kohen is not permitted to contaminate himself. So the Torah says, La yitama, right? That only if she's complete, he should be mitami. So that's a little bit of a chiddush. Now I just want to read to you, the article has a summary of Rabbi Shmuel's view, and I think that'll be a very good introduction to the sugya of Li'olam Behem Tavodu. By the way, what kind of Eved are we talking about? I just want to make sure we're on the same page. An Eved Kanan. Okay, that's very important, because in an Eved Ivri, this whole thing doesn't get off the ground. Adarav, if you free your Eved Ivri, we're going to give you rewards. You know, we'll give you Haagen-Dazs, you know what I mean? Just tell you which ice cream I like if you ever want to buy me ice cream.
What's it called?
No, Haagen-Dazs.
Oh, yeah.
You heard of it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it has the OU.
Yeah.
If you're makban on Chol HaVakum, then you don't want to eat Haagen-Dazs. Okay. So he says the following. In light of the verse that prohibits a Kohen to contaminate himself, right? That's what the Pasuk said, that Kol Nefesh, Linefesh Lo Yitama, we interpret La yitama, he will contaminate himself for her, as just giving permission. In other words, he's allowed to. He may contaminate himself, right? Simon says you may take a step forward, right? Mm. But it doesn't create an obligation. It doesn't say he shall contaminate himself. However, Rabbi Akiva points out that this permission to be metami himself has already been written in the words ki im l'she'ero, and that the exception to the enjoining of the Kohen from being metami himself is the she'ero, is these relatives. So Rabbi Shmuel argues that this verse is not redundant. I would use the word superfluous. He calls it redundant. Doesn't matter, since for her the words la yitama teach a novel ruling. And that is that the Kohen is not allowed to contaminate himself for the sake of her limbs, but only for the complete body. And he will contaminate himself. La Yitame is written accidentally. In other words, he doesn't really need the Yitame, he just needs the word La, pursuant to a dictum from Rabbi Yishmael's academy, which is that sometimes the Torah adds an extra word. Rabbi Yishmael therefore maintains his understanding that he will, which means he shall, and he is, he will means that he's allowed to, right, he may contaminate himself, but not in the case of one of her limbs. Okay, I don't know if that summary adds anything to you. Now we get to Li'ola Bahem Tavodu Rishus, Divrei Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Kiva Omer Chova. So my time in the Rabbi Shmuel, why does Rabbi Shmuel say that you must maintain your ownership over the Eved Knani? And the answer is, we have to put this pasuk, this verse, in a broader context. And since it's written, Lo Sachaya Kol Neshama, we enter into the land of Israel, we cross the Jordan, who's, by the way, at the head of the military campaign,
Yoshua.
And now we have to destroy the seven nations. And Lo Sachaya Kol Neshama, all the seven nations have to be totally obliterated. And the land of Israel has to be freed of every single last member of these seven nations. Now, if you want to go over the list of the seven nations, you'll open up your Siddur in the morning. We mentioned, you know, the Girgashis and all those guys over there. So now, Itzrich Nami, he also needs Lemichtav to write Li'olam Bahem Tavodu, which means that you shall work them forever. And what's the purpose of Li'olam Bahem Tavodu? Lemishre, to allow something that you and I would have assumed would be prohibited. And what is that? Lemishre Echad Mikol Umos. Any member of these other nations, meaning the nations other than the seven nations. And what's the case in which we're going to allow a marriage or some relationship to a member of the other nations? And that's the case of echad mikol ha'umos sheba al haknanis v'holid v'menu ben. Okay, this is really complicated. So you have a member of another nation, let's say, for example, an Italian, and this Italian has a relationship with one of the seven nations, a woman that comes from one of the seven nations that occupied the land. And that's called in the Lashon of the Shas a Knanis, because she's living in Knan. And now they have a son, Shatarashoy Liknoso, that in such a case, you're allowed to maintain an ownership over this child. Now, what does that mean? I would have said just the opposite. That in this case, you'd have to fulfill the mitzvah of Lo Sechaya Kol Neshama. Why? Because who's the mother of this child?
None.
Correct, she's a Knanis.
Oh, the tribe.
Now, if we assume that the yichus, the relationship, is determined, the status of the child and its nationality, by its relationship to the mother, then the status of this child is a Knani. No, we're going to say, and this is the whole point of Liolam Bahem Tavodu, that in this case the child's status is determined not by its mother, but rather by its father.
Jewish.
And therefore you can keep the child alive, and the child becomes an Eved. This Sanya we learned in a Braisa, Minayin, how do we know? We Echa Mina Umos. In the case of one of the members of the nations, that means the nations other than the Knanim, Shebal HaKnanis, he had a relationship with one of the women from the seven nations of Knan. V'olid Mimet Uben, they had a son. Minayin, how do we know? Shatarashoy Liknoso B'Evet. That you can purchase him as an Evet. And that means that he doesn't have the status of a Knani based on his relationship to his mother, but rather his status as a nation is determined by his father. How do we know such a thing? Talmud Lomar, the Torah teaches us, V'gam, now this is a pasuk in Vayikra, it says, V'gam mibnei atoshavim hagarim imachem mehem tiknu, which literally translates as the residents of those who live amongst you, you may purchase. Okay, now let's switch it around. Yochel, I might think, Af haknani shebal achas min ha'umos. What happens if a man who is a knani has a relationship with one of the women of this of the other nation? So now, if we take a look at the mother, then the child belongs to Italy, right? He's Italian, he's not a Knani. But on the other hand, the child's father is a Knani. V'holin mimenu, shatarashoy liknosa b'yeved, is Talmud Lomar, asher holidu li'artzachem, min hanoladim li'artzachem, v'lo min hagorim li'artzachem. So basically, the case of a child that's born from some sort of mixed marriage between one of the nations of the world and one of the others is really depends on both the father and the mother. If both parents are Kananim, they come from these seven nations, then the Torah says Lo Sechai Kol Neshama. But if one of the two parents belongs to a different nation, then the child of that marriage is allowed to be taken as an Eved, but for two different reasons. In the case where his mother is a Knanis, then the Torah goes out of its way to say, Mibnei atoshavim. It means that we take a look at the father, and the father determines the nationality of the child.
Jewish? He's Jewish?
No, it was before Gerus. There was no conversion. But in the case where the mother is the member of the other nations, but the father belongs to the Knanim, then the child is also permissible as an Eved, but for a whole different reason. Why? Because the Torah says, Asher holidu bi'artzachem. And this is a limitation that says that at any time a Jew is allowed to purchase a slave from amongst those children who are born in your land, which means to the case of a Canaanite mother from a non-Canaanite father, v'lomin hagarim bi'artzachem, and not for those children who were born outside the land and they just reside in your land. Okay, Rabbi Osai, we just got to scratch the surface of this brand new sugya. I don't know how far you got. Have you
got to?
Okay, so this last sugya has to be repeated over and over again. I'll just take this opportunity to thank you and wish you all a great Shabbos.
Same time.
And if next time, next week, you want to get together again, which is great, I just have to know a little bit beforehand, are we learning Sota?
Yes.
Okay. Or are we going to learn some sort of halachic topic, you know, which was called modern law?
Your choice. I like Sota.
Yeah. Do a combination like you did today, it was good.
Yeah, of course.
I'll try to weave in a little modern law into Sota. How about that? All right, we'll see if we can accomplish that goal. I'm not promising anything. First, I got to get better.
I have an answer to the limb being Tume.
Thank you.
By the way, take some heavy doses of vitamin C. Start taking them immediately, and that will help.
How do you get a hold of vitamin C in any drugstore?
Yes, and that speeds up the repair of your body.
1,000 milligrams, the big ones. Mm.
Which one?
1,000 milligrams.
1,000 milligrams of vitamin C. What does it do to your gastro?
Makes you much better.
Tell them to take it in the morning.
If there's excess, the body.
Does anybody have a little piece of paper? I can write this down.
You can't sleep.
Oh, well. I'm connected with a company that replicates organs. 3D printing of organs.
Oh yeah, I read about it.
This is the most amazing thing. And what is the organ that they're replicating right now? Corneas. And it's already been in existence for 3 years.
So we don't have to take it from a dead body. You know?
Well, actually, you do. The first cornea is harvested. And from one cornea, they can replicate between 100 and 200 additional corneas. Ugh. So you might argue, therefore, that there is a concept of tuma here. Mm-hmm. Because the cornea has to come from a dead body.
From a dead body, yeah.
Right.
But so I would also wonder, if now medically we know that when an organ becomes detached, there's a short time frame during which the organ remains vital. So I would think there could be an argument that the timing when it remains idle, it hasn't become tome yet.
Right, that's what Gene was saying. And there is such a havamina, but I think if I remember correctly, the poskim have strong proofs that in halacha it doesn't work that way. That once it's been severed from the human body, it's been done.
But the proof that it should work is that if you transplant, if you reattach it,
right,
and it's vital and it continues to, so then the timing was such that it may have not become tome.
Oh, so I'm just telling you that the Gemara says in Yevamos that if somebody touched the Ben Ashunamis before he was resurrected, he's Tomei. But after he's resurrected, if somebody touches his body,
it becomes
Tomei. No, it doesn't work retroactively.
What about the surgeon?
He's a Kohen? If he's a Kohen, I don't know. I'm not sure that surgery is a job for a good Jewish boy as a Kohen.
But the argument against it would be that if the organ became non-vital, the reattachment would fail. So therefore, you as long as it succeeds, it may be revisit the argument.
Right. Yeah. The whole theory of rejection.
Modern science is amazing. You could